Since I entered politics, I have chiefly had men's views confided to me privately. And some of the biggest men in the United States in the fields of commerce and manufacture are afraid of somebody, are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it. And that quote comes from Woodrow Wilson. Welcome to Surviving the Matrix, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Maxwell Egan. It's a pleasure to be with you once again, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Now, on some of my recent radio broadcasts, you may have heard me refer to the work of John Lash. John Lash is a comparative mythologist, and I've been kind of called to his work of late, really due to a series of synchronistic events that just kind of led me to it. And what interests me most about John's work is a book he wrote entitled Not in His Image, in which he brings us his interpretation of a collection of ancient Gnostic texts known as the Nag Hammadi Library. Now, the Gnostic information is important to consider for two reasons. One, in that it provides for us an insight into a mythos that existed well before any type of religious belief systems had been introduced into the human psyche. And it's important to understand this, folks. There are many people who are attempting to portray Gnosticism as being some type of religion, but this is really not true, folks. Gnosticism was more of a way of life. It was more of an understanding of reality than a religion, and there seems to be a very, very concerted effort of late to portray it as a religion. So it's important to realize how this smokescreen is being set up. And the second reason it's important is because if the Gnostic vision is true, then the true message for humanity that is contained within the Nag Hammadi Library may well be one of vital importance. Now, I believe it was in 2006 that John released a book that I previously mentioned entitled Not in His Image, in which he presents for us his interpretation of the Nag Hammadi Library. And I believe John's interpretation of these texts is significant for many reasons, not the least of which is because John Lash is himself a Gnostic, and it would seem logical to assume that the works should be interpreted from a Gnostic perspective. And it is by applying such a perspective to the message that's contained within the text that John Lash has been able to reveal a deeper story that is being told. And this is really no mean feat, folks, being that most of the Nag Hammadi Library was translated from scrolls that were not only very badly damaged, but which were written in Coptic, no less. And on top of that, they were translated by devout Christians, and I could probably dedicate almost an entire show to discussing the inherent problems with that fact alone, but suffice to say that the finished result of the translation being that the true mythos contained within the text is virtually buried in allegory and in biblical interpretations of the themes. And the result in all this, folks, is that what you get if you go and buy the Nag Hammadi Library is a book that is virtually incomprehensible. And it's unfortunate, but it is virtually incomprehensible. You catch little glimpses of things here and there, but it's very, very difficult to make out what's actually being told to you. But fortunately, that is what John Lash has done for us with the interpretation that he gave us in his book, Not in His Image. And look, I could go on forever about this, as I'm sure you know, but I'm fortunate enough to actually have recorded an interview with John earlier in the week. I did want to run the whole show through just as a normal show, but there were a few problems with the connection during the day, and so I've had to edit most of my questions in because this was where most of the dropouts were. And there were also a couple while John was talking, but I think I've managed to edit it all back together, folks, and we have a workable interview. And I will now switch to the pre-recorded conversation with John Lash.
It's my honor and great pleasure to welcome John Lash to the show. Are you with us, John?
Yes, I'm here, Max. Thank you very much.
Now, this really is a huge topic, and there are so many things we could cover here, but like seeing as there is already a substantial amount of talks and interviews that you've done that are widely available on the internet, and you've given quite detailed accounts of the Gnostic vision, So I was thinking that rather than rehash information that's already out there, what I'd like to do with the show today is perhaps move forward a little bit, because there's quite a lot of talk on the internet these days with people using the term Archon. They're using it in the mind predator context. And given that, as I said, much of the information presented to us in the Nagamani Library is incomprehensible in its raw form, I would suggest that most of the understanding that people have of the Archons really does come from your work. So how did this come about? How did you be the one to come to introduce the term Archon into the current discourse? And how do you feel? What is your concern about how the term is being used these days?
Well, thank you for those questions, Max. I agree with you. I don't like to rehash things. I don't like to repeat myself, although sometimes repetition is necessary. As you know, I think it's more important considering the late moment in the battle for human sanity that we're now facing to cut right to those essential and crucial pieces of intel which can really make a difference. And the Archon theme and the Archon profile from Gnosticism is one of those elements of what I'm going to call Gnostic intel. So it's an excellent place to start. Before I talk about how I got onto the Archon aspect of Gnostic teachings, I would like to make two brief statements which resonate with your introduction. For those who have not heard about me or about Gnosticism before now, and even those who have, these are two essential statements. The first one is that the Gnostic vision of life is not an alternative religion. It is an alternative to all religions. That's a really important point. And the second point that I'd like to make is, and I ask those listening, especially for the first time, to really let this sink into their minds. The Gnostic materials that survive in Naha Mahdi are pathetic and fragmentary. And other ex-Naha Mahdi, non-Nag Hammadi materials are also very meager. The historical truth is that the Gnostic message to mankind is the most suppressed message that has ever existed on this planet. So I'd just like you to think about that, that there is something in the Nag Hammadi teachings that has somebody doesn't want humanity to know about. And they have taken brutal measures through centuries to see that this message has been eradicated. Now, fortunately for us, in December of 1945, some fragmentary documents written in Coptic were discovered in a cave in Egypt. And they were reconstructed, edited, translated, and they first appeared around, I think, 1976 in English, in the so-called Nag Hammadi Library in English. And I was at that time living in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've always studied mystical and esoteric subjects through my life, and I have practiced certain forms of experimental mysticism with and without the use of psychoactive plants, which must be distinguished from drugs. And so I had a certain amount of interest in finding out what was in these rare Gnostic materials. And up until that time, around the middle of the 70s, I didn't know that much about what the content and the message of Gnosticism was. No one did, because as I said, there was a centuries-long campaign to destroy that message. Well, I was terribly intrigued. I bought the Nag Hammadi Library in English when it first came out, and I couldn't make head or tails of it. And I can tell you today that anyone reading it or buying it today is gonna face an horrific problem. I mean, you stated that, and how true is that?
Well, it is. It's very, very difficult to read, isn't it? It's all over.
It's gibberish. It's gibberish.
You find little bits in there. There's little bits of stuff in there that I was seeing, and what you've done is bring it all together, and that's why I admire your work so much. So please go on.
Well, it's true that I am the sole scholar of Gnosticism who stands out for two reasons. One is that I am not of the Judeo-Christian tradition. most of the scholars who have translated and interpreted the Gnostic materials are historians of religion, you know, or if they're experts in the Coptic language, their background is going to be in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Elaine Pagels, a professor from Princeton University, who brought the Gnostic writings into the mainstream with her book, The Gnostic Gospels, is a Christian and only accepts a Christian slant of Gnosticism. In fact, her book, The Gnostic Gospels, is very misleading in its title, because it implies that the Gnostic materials from Nag Hammadi were sort of like, you know, lost gospels, right? They were maybe unedited versions like of the New Testament that ought to have been included maybe in the New Testament, but they were cut out for some reason. Well, that is completely misleading. The Gnostic writings, Gnostic philosophy, cosmology, parapsychology, the Gnostic theory of ethics, and the Gnostic profile of the Archons, which we're coming to in a moment, are all entirely unique and outside the realm of Christian theology and Christian Judeo-Christian beliefs. And so I am the only scholar who is a Gnostic who has attempted to tell the world what the Gnostics wanted to say. You see. And secondly, I am the only scholar who has restored in its entirety the myth of the divine Sophia, who was a goddess, if you will, in the Gnostic view of the world, in their mythology, which was not a mythology in the sense of lies, but it was a mythology in the sense of a grand scenario of imagination that carries a transcendent truth about humanity, about our origin, and about the origin of the earth itself. The single most important factor in the Nag Hammadi writings is the narrative of the goddess Sophia, and I call that, for reasons which will become obvious, the fallen goddess scenario. So I restored that, and it wasn't easy. It was very difficult to do because of the fragmentary nature of the materials.
Like I was saying, you can catch little glimpses of it, but what you've done is restored the myth, and I think it's very important for anybody who's looking into the concept of the Archons that they need to have an understanding of this myth, and really it was this myth was what attracted me to your work, because there's just something about this story. But please go on.
There is indeed, Max, something about this story, and I can't tell you, when people write me at my website or write me on my email who have encountered Nod in his image and who have read this story, they all say the same thing. And I find that very encouraging that everyone says the same thing. They all say, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. There's something about this story, this narrative of the goddess Sophia, that really clicks totally for me. And what can I say about that story? Well, first of all, go read it. Just go read the story. You can read it on metahistory.org. If you click on the homepage of the website and you go to click in Fallen Goddess Scenario, and it will come up. What I did was I took the Gnostic materials. I was very rigorously faithful to the textual materials that survived, and I reconstructed the total story or narrative in 9 episodes. So the first thing that anyone should do, if they are even remotely interested in Gnosticism, is to just go read the story. It's like any other story that you might read, and see how it affects you. Now, when I was reconstructing that story and delving into the Gnostic materials during the 90s, leading up to writing my book around 2005 or 2006, I became aware that of what the story actually was. First of all, I became aware over a period of time that there is no comparable myth to this anywhere in the material of any culture on the planet. Now, bear in mind here, you would understand this, Max, but some people might be a little bit thrown off. When I use the word myth, you're hearing a mythologist use that word. And I realize that a myth in conventional discourse can be more or less equated with a lie, you know. For instance, like the myth of, you know, male menopause or something like that, you know. Yeah. So, in conventional language, a myth is a lie. But in the language of a comparative mythologist like myself, a myth is not a lie. In fact, the original word mythos in Greek simply meant a story, a narrative.
It's a lot easier to preserve a story in the form of a myth because it creates a colorful story you can tell around the campfire, and this is traditionally the way history was handed down.
That's right, in oral form in myths. And I would advise listeners to consider that the Darwinian theory of evolution is just a myth, you know, but it's a scientific myth. And the fact that it may or may not have evidence to support it doesn't make it any less a myth. So a myth, as I'm using the word, is a long and powerful narrative with a plot that expresses in a poetic or metaphorical manner certain things which are actually true. Now, one thing to know, and this is important in understanding where the archons come in to the picture, is that the Sophia myth of the Gnostics is astronomical. What I mean by that is that it is a story, a consistent plot that describes events that happened in the solar system and in our galaxy, in this particular galaxy that we inhabit. It is an astronomical myth, and it describes and explains, if you will, the origin of the human species. It explains the origin of the Earth. And it explains the presence in human reality and in our life here on Earth, the presence of a predatory mind parasite called the Archon. Now, I can remember back in 1999, when I was talking with someone in the United States. This was about 2 years before metahistory.org went online. And I was actually talking with this individual about setting up a website. They requested me. A certain foundation I was associated with requested me to set up a website. And they were very interested in the Gnostic materials. And they said, well, if you set up a website and you use it as a teaching platform to present Gnosticism and the Sophianic vision story, as I now call it, are you going to tell about the Archons? And I said, you bet I will. You bet I'll tell about them. And so I do think that I was the one who introduced this term Archon into the discourse on the internet. And the first time that it would have appeared from my writing, from my pen, as it were, would have been soon after metahistory.org went online, and that would have been in June of 2002. So we're looking at just over 10 years now. And what I have seen in those 10 years is a hugely escalating use of this term, Archon. Now, let me explain to listeners my concern about how this term is being used today. The term Archon, found in the Gnostic writings, is from a Greek word, even though the Nag Hammadi writings are in Coptic. About one in every four or five words are in Greek, and they are said to derive from Greek originals. So the word Archon is a Greek word, and what it literally meant back in the days of Alexander the Great in the Roman Empire, it literally meant governor. So the Archon of a certain province of Rome, or the governor of a certain province of Rome, was simply called the Archon. And the Gnostics understood it as to mean a ruler or authority. So in a general sense, an Archon is an authority who tells you what to do. But in a more specific sense, the Gnostics who wrote the Nag Hammadi material, who left it to us anyway, had a cosmic view of what an archon is. And that was the specific profile of the archon as an extraterrestrial predatory mind parasite. And the reason why they called these extraterrestrial predatory parasites archons was because the name derives from the Greek word archai, which means before or from the beginning. And the narrative, the cosmological narrative of Gnosticism, which is the story of the goddess Sophia, describes an event that happened in this galaxy of ours before the Earth was formed. This is a really important point. That's why the archons are called archons, because they were here in this solar system before the Earth was formed in this solar system. Now, the Gnostic cosmology gives quite a detailed picture of the evolution of our solar system. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, it does. Like I said before, it's very important that people, when even looking into the information about the archons, that they look at it in relation to the narrative of the myth, because if they don't look at it within the framework of the myth, well, they're not really getting the whole story. And a lot of people are using the term these days, and they don't seem to be talking about the Sophionic myth. They don't seem to be bringing
Sophia. Well, this is precisely what troubles me. This is precisely what troubles me, and it's beginning to trouble me even more. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I agreed to have this interview with you, and I haven't been doing many interviews lately, was that I can state my case on this, because I think that people out there who are picking up on the idea of the Archon are getting a valuable piece of intel that could change their way of seeing the world and could be very empowering toward for anyone who wants to make a better world and overcome the psychopaths and the control freaks who are running our world. But in order for this term Archon to be helpful, you have to keep it in context. And how can you do that? Well, let me just say quickly 2 points. First point is to understand that the Gnostics considered the Archons to be a primary problem of humanity. The Gnostics were seers and shamans who could look into other dimensions, and they could explore the solar system and the galaxy through their psychic powers. They were very, very skilled shamans and trained in parapsychology, noetics, and the detection of alien forces. And they left a warning for humanity. But humanity didn't get that warning until a little while ago, because somebody didn't want humanity to get the warning. The warning was that there exists in the solar system this horde of predatory ETs who appear in 2 types primarily. One is a neonate type that appears to be a prematurely born fetus. That is to say, with a spindly body, big head, bug eyes. You know, that would correspond to the classical gray ET. And the other type of archon, which is the overlord of the gray ET archons, is the reptilian type of archon. And so the Gnostic seers identified these 2 types of predatory ETs a long, long time ago. But what is really amazing is that they placed them in a scenario. And what bothers me today, as you just said, is that people are throwing around this term Archon 10 years after I introduced it. And they're using it loosely, and they are not referencing it to the source. And if you don't reference it to the source, you can't use it correctly. So what is the source? Well, the Gnostics taught us, and you can find this in the Nag Hammadi materials if you dig around enough, they taught us that the Archons do not come from an advanced civilization elsewhere in the galaxy. They are not superior to humanity. In fact, they are inferior to humanity, and they envy us, and they want to be like us, and they want us to become like them. But they live in the solar system at large. They are the inhabitants of the solar system, and they have, in a certain effect, in a certain respects, created the solar system apart from the Earth, Sun, and Moon. So Gnostic cosmology was very specific in stating that these beings are inhabitants of our solar system, but they cannot inhabit the Earth. The Earth is not a part of the solar system, strictly speaking, in Gnostic cosmology. It is a living planet captured in a non-living or inorganic system, and the Archons are inorganic beings. So that's the first piece of the scenario that you need to put together.
Yeah, well, that would explain as well why the specific celestial mechanics of this solar system exist the way they do. But I think we've reached break time here, John, so I'll have to go and have a break now. And
excellent.
We'll come back in a few minutes. We're here speaking with John Lash, folks. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in a few minutes. So welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're here talking with John Lash, and we're discussing the Nagamani Library and the concept of the Archons. And we were talking about the creation of the solar system just before the break, and John was explaining how the Archons created this solar system according to the Gnostic writings, and I was saying that this explains the particular celestial mechanics of this solar system, because we have a very mathematically perfect solar system, folks. It's not like solar systems that you see. I mean, this is the only one that seems to be like this. And there's also a very, very large space around our particular solar system as well, like there was some sort of an event that happened here. It's a very, very, like we're in the outer rim of the galaxy for sure, but just where our sun is, there's a particular empty space around here. So it's very interesting, mate, when you look at this in the relation to the Gnostic writings, because there's a lot of stuff to confirm what the Gnostics are saying, isn't there?
There is indeed. In fact, I can assure you that not only for myself, but others who have followed the total narrative that I restored and investigated it and checked it out since my book came out, I can assure you that for us, we're finding quite remarkable and ongoing confirmations in science and astronomy that would indicate that the Gnostic cosmology of the goddess Sophia is correct. If you want to just put it in a soundbite, I'll tell you what the Gnostics told us about the creation of this solar system. They told us that the solar system, which we inhabit, which is on the outer edge of the third limb of a four or five-limbed spiral arm galaxy, was produced by a surge or flare or massive plume of energy from the galactic core. This is what they say. And I have found that recent discoveries of astronomy seem to confirm this. And, of course, we can't go into all the details on that right now, but I just ask listeners to leave their minds open to the fact that the Gnostic myth, so-called, is astronomically correct and can be affirmed. And I've written a lot about that in Not in His Image. But let's cut to the really important factor here. And also, thank you for your question, because I have the opportunity to say for the first time why I am increasingly troubled by the way people use the word Archon. You see, it's a very powerful piece of intel. And if you don't use it correctly, it's not going to help you, and it may even mislead you. The main thing that people do is that they pick up the term, they get that it's a psychic parasite of some kind, somehow related to the reptilian and the gray ETs, and then they just go on and say whatever they like about it. They just use the term from a specific Gnostic context in any way they like, but they don't refer to the context from which it comes. Now, the most glaring example of that is that the Gnostic cosmological story of the divine Sophia tells us how the Archons originated. It tells us their origin. But people who use that word today never refer to that. That is really troublesome because it means that they're taking a piece of intel out of a scenario and using it in a reckless way. So the question then is, well, how do the archons originate? How did these mind parasites come about? And the answer to that, according to the Gnostics, is that they came about due to an accident, due to something that was not intended and not foreseen. And that accident is one of the episodes in this 9-episode scenario of the Goddess of Fire, which I've reconstructed. It's a story of things that happened among the gods. Now, according to the Gnostic cosmology, the gods, which they call aeons, A-E-O-N-S, they are powerful forces that are beyond any kind of human or animal form, but they are alive and aware. And these gods or aeons inhabit the core or hub of our galaxy. And the whole picture of this, I'm not inventing any of this, by the way. This is all found in bits and pieces in the Gnostic writings. So the aeons, or the creative or divine gods of the universe, live at the center of our galaxy. And what they do is that they create and observe different experiments. For them, a planetary system is a laboratory setting. And so what they do is they set up experiments from the galactic core, which is kind of like an observation booth where they're operating from, and they project these experiments out into the galactic arms, into the limbs of the galaxy. So the limbs of our galaxy, which consists of some, I think, 200 to 300 billion stars, contain untold numbers of experiments which have been seeded in that realm by these aeonic gods. This is the fantastic perspective of the Gnostic myth. And what they say is that there are particular and strange conditions that pertain to the experiment that we are in. First of all, humanity, which they call the Anthropos, is a genomic plasm, according to the Gnostic teachings. A genomic plasm means that it's a plasm, a cytoplasm, or a protoplasmic substance consisting mainly of nucleic acid that has been created in the galactic center. So if you're a human being and you're wondering where humans come from, and you'd like to know what the Gnostics said, the answer is simple. They said that we were dreamed up as an experiment by these aeonic gods in the center of this galaxy. The next thing that they explain is that there were two particular aeons who were involved in designing the human genome. These are, as it were, our parents. And they are called Sophia and Thelete. And they are male and female aeons because the gods also have gender. So they created a certain type of humanity, and then they sent that plasm out into the galactic limbs by a process which science recognizes, which is called directed panspermia, so that that plasm could seed itself in different worlds that were arising in the galactic limbs, and in that way, these laboratory experiments could unfold. There's one thing you need to know about the Gnostic eons. They're gods, but they're not omnipotent. They don't know everything. They don't control everything. And they don't have a plan with a beginning and middle and an end. They perform great experiments.
That's the important thing to know about this as well, isn't it? That it's an experiment and that it's an open-ended myth. I mean,
we're
part of it right now. That's one of the beautiful things about this story is that it does encompass the whole thing, the whole spectrum. Like you say, it's a galactic-style myth. Something before we go on this, is something we just skipped before that I want to get back to. When you mentioned about Archons, manifesting on Earth, people talking about archons and ETs coming to Earth, archons living on the planet. You mentioned before that archons can't live on the Earth. What's your opinion? For instance, recently in the Sandy Hook shootings and stuff, I mean, there's people saying, oh, it was probably a nest of archons in Sandy Hook. I've heard all sorts of strange things like this. What's your opinion about that sort of talk?
Well, I've thought about that a great deal. And again, I'm concerned that people who use the word archon who aren't well-versed in Gnostic materials, you know, they don't know the Sophia myth. They don't know about what I've just was talking about. They don't agree that humanity was created in the galactic center. But this is what the myth tells us. And, of course, they're speculating wildly about how these archons affect us, you know, and are they taking human form and so forth. I don't have an absolute and definitive answer to that. I can only give you the best answer, my best answer at this moment after long and careful consideration of the question. I pay attention to what the Gnostics said, because if they were able to produce this incredible intel about the divine experiment happening on this planet, then I trust that they knew what they were talking about. They claimed that the archons could appear to have human form or could trick us into thinking that they do, because the main technology of the archons is something called in Coptic HAL, H-A-L, and that word means simulation. The archons, who actually live in the external part of the solar system, not in the Earth or not on the Earth, nevertheless have a technology of virtual reality and simulation by which they can persuade human beings and trick human beings into many, many things. And one of the most, helpful aspects of the Gnostic profile of the Archons is this business about simulation. Because if you look at the world today, you'll see how humanity is completely caught up in devices of simulation.
Oh, absolutely.
Virtual reality. Right.
Well, we do. Everything we're doing is a mirror image. I've spoken about this so much on recent shows, how everything we create is like a mirror image of reality with a reverse meaning. You know, this is almost like the archontic mind. And when you
It is the archontic mind. It is. It's not our mind, because the human animal, the Anthropos, was not designed to live in simulation. The Anthropos was designed to live in the terrestrial paradise of this planet. The laboratory setting of this experiment is the planet Earth. And all of the creatures living in the planet are part of Sophia's experiment. They're part of the goddess's experiment. But humanity has an exceptional part. It doesn't have a superior part, it has an exceptional part, because we are gifted with intelligence that is similar to the intelligence of the aeons themselves, which is called nous. So we are gifted, according to the Gnostics, with a germ of divine intelligence. But the key is, how do we use that intelligence? If the experiment on this planet were operating properly and hadn't been deviated by the archons, which they can do without invading the planet, they do it through the mind and through telepathy and through devices of deceit and persuasion. But if the experiment we're living in now had not been deviated by them, then we, the Anthropos, humanity, would be using our intelligence to live in harmony with the natural world, which is a paradise. This planet is a natural paradise. But we don't live like we're in paradise, do we? We live in a shopping mall, right?
Oh, it's ridiculous. And, like, this is the important thing as well. Like, people that are talking about the archons and they're not looking at it within the context of the myth, I think it's important. If people have read the Nag Hammadi Library, like I said, it's very, very difficult to find the story. It's even very difficult to glean any real information about the archons. I mean, you get it all in allegory presented to you by people who've given it a Christian slant. So it's almost impossible to know what's actually being said. So people that are bringing this information to the world at the moment and looking at the archons in the context of mind parasite, I believe can only really be doing so because they've read your book. So my question is, why aren't they putting it within the context of the myth? Because looking at the archons from just the perspective of the archons of this mind parasite can be very, very disempowering for people.
Max, that's it. You put your finger on it. And I, as the person who has introduced not only the term the archons and the Gnostic profile, but who has restored the story, consider it to be tragic that people today would be talking about the archons, such as my colleague Jay Widener, he's a very well known person on the internet, but not citing the entire story about these archons, because the story of the divine Sophia, the Anthropos generated from the galactic center, what were the original designs and purposes of this experiment, and what is the role of humanity in this experiment to make it succeed, all of that leads to solution. The archons are a problem, and they're a very big problem, and I've talked a great deal about this. And as far as the answer to this question, do archons turn into human beings? No, it's worse than that. Human beings turn into them.
Yeah, that's a very, very good way of putting it, actually, John. That's a very, very good way of putting it. Because it's a mind parasite, and I would suggest that this is what psychopaths are. It's almost like it's a mind that is totally controlled by the archon mind. And the interesting thing as well is the synchronicity that's led me to this work, because when I went off and did my travels last year, I went and did ceremony in Peru, and I actually experienced a real connection to the goddess and a real connection to reality that I'd never experienced before. And then my trip led me off and all of this work just sort of fell straight into my lap, and that was everything that I'd experienced in ceremony. And so I think that there is a great deal to this, and it's very important that people pay attention to the story.
Well, you bring up two really crucial points here, and these points, I tell you, they burn in my soul every day. One point is that the Gnostics and the Teleste, as they call themselves, we who are aimed of the ancient mysteries, used entheogenic plants in order to keep their minds open to the true nature of reality and to the nature of this divine experiment we're in. And so the issue of the correct use, the ritual and correct use of entheogenic plants, sacred plants, not drugs, but the gifts of nature, is extremely important in discussing how we deal with the archons. And the second thing, and this is really the flame that burns in my heart the strongest, I'll put it in the form of a question. I would like to know why anyone would take the archon intel from me, who takes it out of the Sophia story, and not refer to the story. I would like to know why. It doesn't make any sense. And I advise all the people listening to me now to be suspicious about anyone who does that. The story is about a goddess. And that goddess, who engineered the human genome in the galactic center, is now, according to the Gnostic teachings in this story, living now, embodied in this very planet itself. She is the mother goddess. Sophia is the true, unique, and supreme mother goddess of this planet. And so there's a fantastic opportunity, through knowing her story, to merge your life and your fate into the life and fate of this planet. And that is the mission and the challenge that the Gnostic teachings present to us, and it points toward solution. And there are many, many aspects of solution that can be derived by looking in that direction and using the myth to guide your life and to guide your imagination. That's its purpose.
And that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, the Gnostics, the Telestai, the word Telestai itself means those who are aimed, doesn't it?
Those who are aimed. Such a beautiful term. Those who are aimed.
It is, and it is your belief of reality and the story of who you are that aims you. And when you look at the state of humanity at the moment and the state of this planet at the moment, I don't think we've been aimed in a very good direction, and we're aimed by the myths that guide us, and it's very, very important what myth we're looking at and what story we're buying into. It really is, because this is our future we're creating here, and we are part of it. We are part of history. We're writing history right now, and we often forget that. And I like the word that you used there was opportunity, because that's what I see all this as. I see this huge awakening that's happening at the moment as opportunity, and it's an opportunity for us to get involved, but we've got to get involved in the real story.
Well, a big part of the solution for humanity, and that is humanity as a whole, and for each one of us individual human animals, is the right use of imagination. And I can assure you that I've spent my whole life trying to understand the dynamics and the operation of human imagination. It is the greatest power that the human animal has. The Gnostics called it the luminous epinoia, and they had a lot to say about the power of human imagination. But I will just say this, since we've getting down to the last few minutes of our interview here. If you're not using your imagination, somebody else will. And so the question is, how are you going to use it? What are you going to use to direct it? And the Gnostics call themselves telestai, meaning we who are aimed, because they followed a practice, I call it a visionary practice, in which they trained their imagination within the frame of this story. The purpose of the Sophianic myth is not like any other religious myth or scientific myth or ET fantasy delivered by New Age channelers. No. It is a unique and incomparable story that has the power to guide the imagination of humanity and to aim us to our true purpose, to our true role on this planet, and to reveal the nature of the divine experiment that we are in. And the moment for the Gnostic message is now, and more important than ever right now, in order to heal this experiment and to correct this experiment. In fact, the idea of correcting what has gone wrong with the experiment here is even given to us in Gnostic myth. You made the observation, Max, and it's extremely important, and I'm glad, because I wouldn't want to have overlooked it in this short talk. It does not have the last chapter. Humanity itself are called to write the last chapter and to complete this myth and to complete this story and carry it forward in the future. This is the only myth that you will find among all the religious narratives of the world that remains open-ended and that invites humanity itself to join the goddess, to join the intelligence of the earth to your intelligence, and to write the continuing chapters of this story. And so it's a great tragedy when people use the Archon element of her story and they do not talk about her story or even talk about her.
Yeah.
The living earth.
It's very important, I think, to look at it in the correct context. It really is. And for those listening out there, I will post what I believe are some more poignant conversations that I've heard John have. I'll post them on the Crow House. I'll actually open a section for you, John. I'll put it in the recommended viewing section, and I'll get some people to get the information. And John's websites, again, for those who missed them before, are metahistory.org. and GaiaSpora.org, and I'll put links to them on the website as well. What would you like to finish with, John? We've got probably about 2 or 3 minutes left. Anything you'd really like to leave the listeners with?
Sure. Since this subject of the Archon seems to be the thing that attracts people to the Sophianic story.
It's interesting that we always go for the dark side, isn't it? I would suggest that that's
the right
mind as well. We go for the ugly machine part, and it's all very intriguing, but we don't look at the whole myth. It's an interesting part of our psyche, isn't it?
But there's also an instinct for survival working there. Just like any other animal, we know that there's a predator in our midst. And so when we hear the Archon word, we perk up our ears. You say, we know. But I would say this, that the information about the Archon predator is not going to be helpful unless we eliminate one massive blind spot in the human view of things. And that blind spot is that people, even relatively enlightened people today, still think that the Earth is an inert material body. The Earth is not an inert material body. It is a living being. She is alive, she's intelligent, and she can communicate with human beings. And the Gnostics, the Telestai, communicated with her directly. And it is by connecting and communicating with the living Earth that we can correct this experiment and that we can manage to repel and defeat the Archons. But without that connection to the living Earth, it's not possible.
Very, very, very important information, John. Very important indeed. And I really do hope people go and check out your work. The book is Not in His Image, ladies and gentlemen. Please check it out. And that was about all I was able to salvage out of the interview, folks. There was a little bit more, but unfortunately I was unable to bring it to you due to connection problems on the day. But John Lash has done some fascinating research, and he's an incredibly interesting man to talk to. I could have had a conversation that went for many hours and still probably only have scratched the surface of the information that's contained within his work. And the concept of the Archons may seem very, very out there to people, but it's interesting that the story exists, and it's also very interesting that we find scientific evidence to support the Sophianic myth and the Gnostic vision of the creation of Earth. And it's also important to remember, folks, that though it may sound far-fetched, there are other religious tales that I would suggest probably sound more far-fetched. I mean, let's face it, folks, the Christian vision of the creation of man contains a scenario whereby man was led from his path by woman because a woman accepted the advice of a talking snake. And I can't see anybody finding any evidence to support that one. And yet many people are prepared to believe such a ridiculous concept, and that is the story that they allow to aim them in their life. And when one looks at the world today, I don't think we are aimed in a very good direction, folks. I think we need to be careful where we are aimed. And truthfully, folks, I do find it to be quite amazing that someone could believe a story such as the talking snake scenario, and yet question the Gnostic version and suggest that the Gnostic version is a ridiculous concept, because I would suggest that the Gnostic version is actually far more sensible than the creation myths contained within modern monotheistic religions. But the truth is, folks, that really when you start looking into the nature of this solar system, you start looking into the nature of our civilization, you start looking into the things we spend our time doing, how we have created a wedge between the sexes and we are so intent on creating artificial life and all of the things we do, folks, and there would appear to be a great deal of evidence to suggest that the Gnostic vision is in fact true. And I'm not saying that it is 100% true. I'm not saying that I'm 100% certain that anything is true. But what I am saying is that in attempting to decipher the real problem and figure out exactly what is going on here so we can find a real solution, it's important to look at all the information. And the Gnostic vision is certainly one that is worth considering. But folks, that is it for me for today. I will have to try to get John on the show again because, like I said, I could talk to the man for hours, and I would really like to have a discussion with him regarding a project that he's involved in called Planetary Tantra, which I did want to touch on, but unfortunately just didn't get time. So I have to see if I can have him back on at a later date. But that is it for me, folks. Thank you very much for joining me on the air today. Thank you to anybody who's ever made a contribution to the website. Be sure to go and check out metahistory.org and check out some of John Lash's work. I'm sure that anybody who listens to this show will find it interesting. Please take good care until we speak again next week. In Lakesh.